This week, it works for the music industry and now it's working for farmers. We'll see how crowdfunding is helping a couple of pig farmers. And we join students in regional South Australia who are getting blown away by science. The tiger prawn season has started in WA. We go inside the processing shed and we'll make a return visit to the Bottle Bend Wetland Reserve near Mildura. A few years ago, it was a toxic disaster with dead trees and battery acid like sludgy water. Now, it's brimming with life.
We're looking at about 450 hectares of the reserve, so it's quite an undertaking, and we actually think it could be the largest environmental watering program for black box in New South Wales, so it's pretty big.
Amazing what a bit of water can do, bringing Bottle Bend back from the brink a bit later. But first this morning to the Riverina and a very modern way to raise funds.
It works for the music industry and now it's working for farmers. Hello, I'm Larissa Smith and I'm talking about crowdfunding. The money-raising scheme where supporters pledge money to get a project up and running. In this case, it's a brand new $18,000 commercial kitchen and charcuterie on Lockie and Lauren Mather's free-range pig farm on the Murray River at Barham in southern New South Wales. The Mathers were looking to expand their herd of 40 Berkshire sows and value-add their product without taking out an expensive bank loan. With the donations they've received, they're building the special kitchen where they'll make the range of cured pork products. It fits neatly in beside the butchery and boning room they built last year. And that's where I find them working this morning.
Just the shoulder, and then the loin right through here. The legs will turn into prosciutto, the middle section will turn into pancetta, and probably some lonza, which is the loin, and this will get turned into copper and salami. We did a salami pig last year. It was our first old breeder that we did, and we just sort of was having less and less piglets every time, and then she sort of didn't have any for a few, and then so we took poor old Betty to the abattoir, and geez, it was emotional. I was beside myself. And looked at her at the butcher's and...
We've still got a head
in the freezer. I couldn't part with it.
Is that normal?
Oh, I don't know. It's a bit clipped over. I don't know. She was one of our first pigs and we'd had her for 4 years. And she was old when we got her. Oh, she's probably eight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I'm interested to see what her salami turned out like. There we go.
We first started pig farming because... when I owned the Long Paddock Food Store, we were getting pork in to cook pork belly and pork shoulders all the time, and just the quality of pork really varied. And the more I looked into it, the more I was really unhappy with the fact that we couldn't actually get free-range pork, especially local, because I was getting so interested in local food and where our stuff was coming from. And that's sort of why the shop was set up, to showcase local food. I was like, wow, there's no one doing local free-range pork. So we bought the first sow with the hope just to run her offspring through the shop, but then she was a bit lonely, so we got her a friend, and then we just fell in love with them. The more pigs we got, the more we fell in love with them and the more we wanted to farm them free range.
Why did you turn to crowdfunding to build a commercial kitchen and smoking room?
We actually looked at crowdfunding when we initially wanted to set up the farmstead butchery. It was quite difficult at that stage because we didn't have a lot of stock on the ground, and when you're doing a crowdfunding campaign, the idea is that you repay your supporters with something, and in our case it would be pork products. It took a few good years, 2 good years, to get my head around the whole idea of it. We could have gone and got a loan.
Yeah, why didn't you get a loan from a bank, like most farmers?
Yeah, well, we did. We haven't got a loan for any of the stuff that we've done so far. So we paid off the butchery that was about $40,000. We just chipped away at that and got it finished ourselves. So we own all that. But the second part for the charcuterie, it's a bit of an unknown. Like, we don't know that these products are going to be really successful. Like, we love charcuterie, but how do we... Like, it's... it's a bit risky. Like, how do we know that customers aren't going to like it? So I guess if
farmers take risks all the time.
Yeah, we take a lot of risks. I don't really have many. I have gut feelings about things, and that's how we run our business. I think this is going to work, and we just go for it. And so went with the charcuterie side of things. It was, you know, if we crowdfund this, we don't have to take out a loan. We don't have to pay interest back. And it's engaging people as you go along, and it gets people excited about your product. So immediately we've got a market for our products when they're ready.
How long did it take you to raise the capital?
30 days.
Were you surprised that complete strangers wanted to give you money to start this enterprise?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's crazy. Like, people out there just seem to be wanting to support good things, and it's so nice to think that people, you know, want to help other people get off the ground with some projects. I mean, people start cafes and, you know, launch CDs and books on there, and I just think it's a really good way of engaging with customers and or people, other like-minded people that want to see good things happen.
You've taken a lot on. How do you expect to manage the smoking of the meats, the farmers' markets, the farm tours, sending your product to Melbourne to your various suppliers, and, you know, running a family as well?
You're raising two kids. It's really busy. We are crazy busy, but it's kind of organised chaos now. I've got a girl working for me on the farm, and at the moment we've got a young girl living with us. She's from France, so it's a good help. But down the track, you know, I really want to help contribute to the local economy, and we'd like to employ a few people on the farm. So it'd be nice to go to work every day with two or three people and get lots of product out the door, and yeah.
Can you see more farmers taking advantage of this crowdfunding craze in Australia?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a great opportunity. It's a good way too to it's like when grants become available and they're structured a certain way, you can sort of, your imagination and your creative side comes out, and you can put some really innovative applications into farming. It makes sort of people think outside the box, and value adding is huge potential in Australia for value adding. It's just, it's a lot of extra work, and you've just got to be prepared to take that on. But, you know, it's called value adding for a reason. Yeah.
It looks tricky with the gloves on. They're a bit slippery.
To some, the fishy whiff is absolutely unbearable. But for others, it's just part and parcel of the job.
You can see why I call them the tiger prawns.
G'day. I'm Lucy Bell, and I'd like to welcome you to a prawn processing factory in the town of Carnarvon, which is halfway up the coast of Western Australia. The Norwest Seafood Shed has reopened for the season, with staff busy processing prawns for both the domestic and export trade.
That export freezer gives you an idea of how much prawns.
Luckily for me, I don't mind the smell of seafood too much, so I've donned a very attractive hairnet and a good solid pair of rubber boots to follow the prawn trail. My guide is factory manager Belinda Halden.
We're just in the main section of the factory. This is our morel grader. This is where all our prawns go through, and the computer grades it into the different sizes. Mainly we produce the prawns off here for the Japan market. We can run two lines, so you can average quite a few tonne a day.
When the prawns come in off the boat, are they frozen out at sea and then brought in?
Yeah, that's correct. All the prawns, they have a section of the 5 kilos they freeze on board for the domestic and export market. They go direct off the boats, but other products just frozen in your 10-kilo cartons, which is we produce here in the factory.
So what would a typical day involve for you, Belinda, being in charge of this facility? What time do you have to come in?
We usually start about 7 and make sure the checks are done and everything's right for the staff that come in at 8 o'clock, and just go through the usual day of checking and making sure the grading and all the product's good and making sure the staff are on their game.
And we're wearing some pretty sexy hairnets at the moment, which is part of their uniform. What else does staff have to make sure that they're wearing and be aware of?
It's the full quality controls, your hairnet, your boots, your aprons, and you're not allowed to wear your earrings or your perfume or your makeup. It's all controlled under the export standards.
And how long have you been working here, Belinda?
I've only just returned last year, but before that I worked 10 years in the same factory.
And have you seen many changes in those 10 years? Does it look very different to you coming back now?
No, nothing much has changed, which sort of says that if you've got a good thing, why change it?
Do you think we could have a little closer look at the machine over here? Look.
Yeah, we can give you a rundown. On this machine, it's all whole prawns, so the guys are just packing them into their 1.5 kilo cartons. They're also inspecting the prawns for any damage, like loose heads.
What happens to all of the less than up to scratch prawns?
We just send it to our other area in the factory where we produce the prawn meat and the cutlets, so nothing goes to waste and there's a market for everything, basically.
What do you do with the broken and leftover shells? You guys must have a pretty serious disposal unit here somewhere to get rid of all of that fishy-smelling offcuts.
Well, the fish out at the back of the factory are quite well fed certain times of year. We have a machine that minces all the heads and shell up, and that's all regulated through the EPA and Environmental Protection. These are just their hoppers. They get full of salt water.
How many workers would you have on any sort of given day in here usually, Belinda?
Now, things have scaled down since back in the old days, but to run the morel area, you're probably looking at about 12 people, and your cutlets probably another 10. It is only a small workforce since a lot of the product now goes directly from the boat to the buyer. This is what we call the latent area. This is where all the peeling of the meat and prawn cutlets is done. We do have a machine that peels the prawns, but with the restaurants in Perth and around Australia and that, they seem to prefer the hand-peeled stuff these days because it's a lot more delicate and then the prawns look a lot better, and we also devein them as well so we can get a lot higher price for them.
And you've got a team in here of about 10 people standing there peeling prawns?
Yep, this is their first week. We've just started up. There's only a couple of people that were here last season. They're all new girls, mainly backpackers, but they seem to do a really good job compared to what the guys do.
And what sort of prawns are being peeled here, Belinda?
At the moment, it's just your common tiger prawn.
Are all prawns exactly the same to peel?
No, the tiger prawns seem to be a lot easier than your king prawn, but it just all depends. A lot of it's soft shell, so it comes down to the experienced peeler of how fast they can get the shell off.
Is there a sort of a record on this floor? Like, who's the fastest prawn peeler in Carnarvon?
I think those people have long gone, but we've started doing a little contest today and we already have someone who's up above the rest, but we haven't finished our little contest today yet.
What about you, Belinda? How fast can you peel a prawn?
Depends how hungry I am.
The fast prawn peeling Belinda Holden speaking with Lucy Bell at Carnarvon in Western Australia. Still to come on Rural Reporter today, getting regional students interested in science. This project involves a weather balloon, and the Bottle Bend wetland gets a much needed drink.
When we first took it over, it was it'd been through 6 or 7 years of very heavy drought, and there was a lot of problems with acid sulphate and everything else through the reserve. Yeah, so it's looking much better now.
And that is something of an understatement. If I wasn't seeing it with my own eyes, I'd be hard-pressed to believe it's the same wetland I visited just a couple of years ago. Then it was littered with dead trees and battery acid-like sludgy water. Now it's teeming with bird life and the local black box have burst back into life.
pH levels now are back to the same as the Murray River, which is virtually neutral. When we first got it, it was levels as low as 2, which for the river being around 7. Now it's all quite equal with the river and no problems at all.
Hello, I'm Deb O'Callaghan at Bottle Bend Reserve, a wetland on the Murray River just across the border from Mildura in southwest New South Wales. So what's turned things around so dramatically here? What's brought Bottle Bend back from the brink? Well, the answer is water, lots of it. Mother Nature has helped out with a couple of flood events, and the area's also benefiting from 2,000 megalitres of environmental flow. Ian Kelly is from the New South Wales Department of Trade and Investments.
Two flood events, one in 2010 and then another in 2011. Both were quite rapid moving water, which ripped out a lot of the problems, the heavy metals that are deposited in here. And that really saved the area.
What about the recovery of the landscape?
It's been fantastic, and I can probably put most of that down to just rainfall, but it's also with the reduction of grazing in here, that's helped significantly as well. We've done works on rabbit control as well and tried to eradicate feral goats that were in here, and that's made a big impact on allowing it to get away. There's vegetation species in here that we're starting to see that we haven't seen in here for ages, so it's good.
And we've got an environmental watering program at the moment. Should we go over and have a look at that?
Yep, we can go over and have a look at the water, and the pump's turned off, but we can look at the rest of it.
Yep.
Sasha Healy, Environmental Water Manager for New South Wales Office of Environment and Heritage. Well, we are very excited. This is our second year of environmental watering at the Bottle Bend Reserve. The floodplain area, particularly of Black Box up there, is getting a second drink.
So it had one last year?
It did. Last year was our sort of trial, and this year we're a little more serious, and we're getting some fantastic results.
How much water are we looking at?
This year, we'll be delivering 2,000 megalitres. So far, we've delivered just a smidge over 1,000, so we're halfway there.
Yeah. And what sort of area do you hope that covers?
Well, I will do a proper mapping of this, but we're looking at about 450 hectares of the reserve. So it's quite an undertaking, and we actually think it could be the largest environmental watering program for Black Box in New South Wales. So it's pretty big.
So you're recreating what nature should be giving these trees?
We're trying to. So, I mean, they're not typically getting water every year. That's not what would occur in the past. But certainly during big flood events, which we as now have captured, they would have gotten their a little more regular drink than what they have received. And what I mean by that is it was a good 20 years ago that they received their last drink naturally or via a flood.
That's amazing they're even still standing.
It is, and I guess Ian sort of drew to a point earlier that there's been quite a bit of rainfall, so that's kept a lot of things ticking along, but there's still evidence, particularly of the mature Black Box, of struggle, and you can tell they're struggling firstly by death in the limbs, in the canopy of the trees, but also there's these shoots of growth from the actual trunk rather than the tips of branches, and that just shows Struggle Street.
And you're also looking for who's living out here? How are they responding, the animal kingdom?
Well, it's very exciting, I have to say. And look, about 5 species of frogs are using this site even now. And, you know, people typically think frogs pack up and go to bed over winter, but a lot of frogs are still quite active. We've got numerous water birds out here, so teals and wood ducks and mountain ducks and Eurasian coots and some in the hundreds. Got a pair of lovey-dovey black swans out there canoodling. But also little important species like microcrustaceans and microinvertebrates and macroinvertebrates, which are a huge source of productivity to feed fish and birds. So it's all just teeming with life out here, especially at the moment.
My biggest thing is to the contrast from when we first took it over in 2010 to see it now, with the watering program, with the ducks and everything else going through here, particularly the parrot life that's come through here with a lot of the trees having hollows. This bat numbers are quite high. It's just fantastic. It's been a massive change.
What's the plan? What's the hope for this area? It's had a bad reputation for a long time. What's the hope for the future?
Just to let it get back to its natural environment. We've currently just had a management plan done of the area, which is open for public comment at the moment. And the hope of that is to have a trust developed to manage the area in the future, which would be made up of the public. The local community love this site. It's a great fishing area. It's a great camping area. So we want to get it back to being used by the public. And when they come back out here, they're going to see it and it's what it should be, and not, you know, a deserted, desolate area that was before.
Weather is a pretty big deal in the country. Everyone wants to know if it's going to rain or shine. But just how tricky is it to get the forecast right?
Yeah.
And it was supposed to burst at 17 kilometres, but it's just burst now at 19, so it's gone higher than expected.
Oh.
Which is cool.
Good.
Yeah.
Hello, I'm Lauren Waldhuter. Well, these Year 10 students in front of me in Mission Control are experiencing firsthand just how hard it can be. Their first trial weather balloon has just burst somewhere over the mid-north of South Australia. Max from Yorktown Area School and his mates have been monitoring its journey.
So we find the altitude, the speed it's ascending and descending at, and predict where it's going to go. It went up further than we expected. It went up about 22 k's, I think it was. So it took a while to burst.
Max and his colleagues come from 10 schools scattered across the Mid-North and York Peninsula regions, and they've come together in Burrough for today's big launch. It's all part of a project to get students in regional areas interested in thinking about a possible future career in science. It's a collaboration between the University of South Australia, the Defence Science and Technology Organisation, and the State Education Department, where Aaron Warne is from.
It's pretty easy for kids who spend a lot of their time with textbooks and that sort of thing to think that science is an abstract sort of concept, but you don't study science to be a scientist anymore. You study science to be an electrician or even welders or anything. We've just divided the students into teams, just like we would a real space launch. So there's a mission control cell, there's a balloon cell that are responsible for inflating the balloon that you can see behind me. There's a payload cell who are responsible for all of the equipment that will actually be launched with the payload. And of course there's a recovery cell whose job it is to monitor and track the balloon, liaise with the local police and landowners and all of that sort of thing. Retrieving it in this part of the world is going to be a really complex job, and the kids are doing a great job with it.
The balloon needs to be able to hold about 4.5 kilograms of equipment, including tracking devices and a GoPro. Students will be able to work out how high it went, how far it's gone, and importantly, where it lands once it bursts. Out in the shed, a group of students are inflating the enormous latex balloon, which is now about 2.5 metres high. Ben from Minleton District School has been sitting patiently on the floor, holding it for about 20 minutes as it's filled with helium.
Making sure the balloon doesn't hit the ceiling, really.
What do you think about being involved with a project like this?
I know, it's exciting, it's fun. I've always been interested in like a job in science and engineering and stuff, so that's why I've come along.
Is it hard to get experience like this or opportunities like this when you live in a regional area, do you think?
Yeah, the opportunities don't come up very often, so you take them when you can, really.
This is a sentiment echoed by Burrough Community School's senior science teacher, Michelle Pullen.
This is one of those things that all science teachers wish we could do every year with all of our science kids, and we can't. And so the chance for them to do this is just amazing, especially some of our students who are interested in science but not sure where to go and the engineering. And the fact that we've got them hosting this event here today means our other students who are unable to go into the actual program get to see it as well. So, and our whole school is going to come and watch the launch, so everyone's been talking about it, and that is the best thing we can do for science.
And as well, growing up in a regional area, I'd imagine it would be hard for some students to access the same opportunities as their city counterparts, for example.
That's a big part of it. It's more of a case of being regional. Unis are very scary to them because it's not just not school, it's in the city as well. So seeing the universities and the universities coming out here for them, it takes away that mystifying of, oh my gosh, what is this? What am I doing? And makes for a lot of them a... oh, it would be nice option into something real and concrete they can start aiming for.
It's a very delicate operation. There's a group of about 7 people leading the balloon, covered in a red blanket in case it pops, down to the school oval. And waiting on the oval is about 200 school children gathered to watch it launch.
Pretty confident that this is going to work.
All the equipment is tied to the balloon ready to go, and it's slowly lifted up into the air. But then a gust of wind snaps the rope and the balloon rises up into the atmosphere, leaving its precious cargo on Earth. It's a blow to the hard-working students, but their spirits aren't dampened.
I could see it coming because it was pulling that way so hard, and I was just like, oh, that little fish hook thing, that's just going to snap.
But I guess as scientists, this is what you have to be prepared for, isn't it?
Fault and error, that's the way to go.
Now, it's not as bad as you think. We've heard the students manage to successfully launch a second weather balloon later that day. It wasn't as big as the first one, but it did manage to carry all their equipment high up into the atmosphere, so that is some good news.